Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 787 is simply clarifying language that case management and community support services are people with schizoaffective disorder are covered. Currently, people with schizophrenia and with mood disorders are already covered. There are more and more diagnoses of patients with a combination of multiple disorders. This is purely clarifying the fiscal note so there is no fiscal impact. We'd appreciate your support. 30 seconds.
Do you want me to move the bill, Mr. Chair?
Okay. No, I want you to first move the adoption of the division report.
Right. I move the adoption of the division report, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Saxon moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Right.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Saxon, did you?
I move Senate file 787 passed and sent to the floor.
And members will note, Senator Marty has indicated that this is a fairly simple bill with an addition of a diagnosis, and that there is no fiscal impact insofar as the state budget is concerned. On Senator Saxog's motion, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, or your testifier, how many of the population are been diagnosed with this disorder that would add to the cost of treatment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I'll let Ms. Abdur-Holden speak to the number of people, but these folks are already being diagnosed as one or the other, either the mood disorders, depression, so on, or the schizophrenia. But the psychiatrists are more and more wanting to say they have a dual diagnosis. They want them to be covered through both. It's not adding any new people. That's why there's no additional cost. But the psychiatrists say they want to be more accurate in their diagnosis, and they're afraid they won't be covered if they are.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Abdur-Holden, how many people then would be given a double diagnosis as far as these individuals?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abdur-Holden from NAMI, Minnesota. It's about 1% of the population, so similar to schizophrenia. It is a diagnosis that's being used more and more, but in order to make sure that someone can get case management early instead of having to fail numerous times, which is it's still a pretty serious illness, they can go ahead and get that diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder and actually be treated earlier. Or what happens is the psychiatrist or clinical psychologist would have to say that they are living with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder in order to get them in, and it's just better to just be straight up about it.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Abdur-Holden, they are being treated now. It's just that by combining them together, you get a better overall return on your investment or what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, yes. Anytime we can make sure that people are getting the correct diagnosis, so they're getting the correct treatment, and we're not having people kind of come up with different things in order to get into the system, that is a better thing.
Okay. Further questions? If not, we have Senator Saxog's motion that Senate File 787 be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Next, Senator Rosen, we have a couple of your bills. 1077 is on the agenda first. Is that what you'd like to take? Or
Mr. Chair, could we do Senate File 373, please?
Certainly.
There's some people from out of town. Dr. Stirk.
So Senator Lurie moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that modifies the MA coverage to include consultations with psychologists and the advanced practice registered nurses that was amended on health finance, I believe. The bill basically creates a pathway to provide integrated care recognizing the comorbidity between mental health, substance abuse, and chronic physical conditions. Currently, they do not receive Medicaid reimbursement for provisions of psychiatric consultation to primary care providers. And, Mr. Chair, there is no fiscal note on this, and it is something that's been strongly worked out among all of the stakeholders, and I'm open for questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions of Senator Rosen for Senate Files 373?
Chair, Senator Rosen described it very well.
Senator,
it
was
non-controversial. I would move Senate File 373 be recommended to pass.
All right, all those in favor of moving Senate File 373 as amended from here to the floor, correct? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The bill moves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And passes.
Thank you, Senator Lurie.
And are you ready to do the other?
I sure am,
bill?
Mr. Chair. Senate File 1077.
So I need someone to move adoption of the committee report.
So moved.
Senator Lurie, all in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. All right, so that committee report is before us, and I need someone to move the bill. Senator Newman moves for consideration Senate File 1077. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. All right, the bill is before us. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a bill that came to light because of some of the issues that were happening, especially with the methadone clinic up in Duluth. There was some, there was definitely a lack of oversight at the clinics that are dispensing methadone there. There was some hearings that happened last fall in the House. And so the Department of Human Services methadone policy bill has been heavily worked out with all the stakeholders. It is part of the Minnesota State Substance Abuse Strategy that the Commissioner of Human Services has been going around the state advocating for. It is intended to ensure safety and the protection of the participants in the state's methadone clinics as well as the public. Currently, there are 14 methadone clinics in the state that are regulated by and responsible to six state and federal agencies, including the Minnesota Department of Human Services, the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, the DEA, federal DEA, and SAMHSA. So this bill replicates many of these regulations under the Department of Human Services Office of Inspector General, Mr. Kerber here, and the goal of bringing these changes under the OIG at DHS is to promote the safe and medically appropriate use of methadone for opiate addiction. So the bill did pass Health and Human Services Policy, Judiciary, and Health and Human Services Finance, Senator Lurie's committee. And like I said, this has been worked through with the department and the stakeholders. A lot of the clinics, the methadone clinics, want this piece of legislation because there's many clinics that are doing it very well out there, and they want to make sure that all the clinics fall under the same regulations and guidelines. And there is no fiscal note to this, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have Mr. Kerber here with me to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions of Senator Rosen or Mr. Kerber? Senator Engelbrechtsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And to Senator Rosen, I would like to have you explain line, page 13, line 13.30, please, on new legislation.
Jeez. Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Can you give us that?
I know we passed this, but I'd like
Senator
a little
Engelbrechtsen.
Actually, Matt.
I'm sorry, did you say page 13?
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my question. I'm sorry.
Any other questions of Senator Rosen or Mr. Kerber? If not, Senator Newman renews his motion for Senate File 1077 to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Yeah. Appreciate it.
I think Senator Pappas, are you ready?
Yep.
Oh, is she here? Is Senator Dezik here? Okay, I don't see her, so Senator Pappas. Senator Pappas, would you like to start with 1006?
We'll start with 1006.
So it should be both first?
All right.
Mr. Chairman and members.
So are you moving adoption of the committee report, Senator Pappas?
I'll move adoption of the committee report.
All right. All those in favor of adoption of the committee report, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say nay. The committee report is adopted. And Senator Pappas, are you moving?
Not yet.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to explain the bill first. And this is a bill that I've been working on with Allied Charities. And Section 1 of the bill raises the current audit threshold from $500,000 to $750,000. This would relieve 128 charities from an outside audit, which can cost up to $5,000 annually. Section 2 allows the Link Bingo manufacturer to purchase a bond of not less than $100,000. The manufacturer can purchase a higher amount if desired. Section 3 raises the number of off-site events from the current 4 to a proposed 12. County fairs, church festivals, and city days are all examples of off-site events. Section 4 is a proposal to have electronic deposits to match current paper deposit requirements of 4 days from the current 2 days for electronics. Oh, okay, great. This is proving to be a hardship for charities with more than one site. The current 2 days has added expenses to charities involved in electronics. And Section 5 will raise the current paper pull tab receipt requirement from the current $50 to a proposed $100. There's no questions, Mr. Chairman. Then I do have the A3 amendment.
Any questions before the A3 amendment? All right, so we will take up the A3 amendment.
The A3 amendment, we accidentally were deleting language on page 3 that we intend to delete. And section 6, line 1.7 of the A3 amendment.
Senator Pappas, can we wait just one moment
until
everyone receives it, please?
Sure.
And while we are waiting for everyone to receive that amendment, I think on the last bill when I passed it, I said that it should go to the General Register. I realized that we are not the House and we are the Senate. So know that the correct intent is well placed here.
You're asking for forgiveness?
I just expedited the process. Is that what I did? That's right. Everyone in receipt of the amendment? All right, the A3. Senator Pappas, now you can take us through the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I forget, Senator Anderson also introduced a bill that had some of these provisions in it. So thank you for that. Finishing up with the A3 amendment, we're reinstating stricken language, as I mentioned, that was inadvertently struck. And the Section 3, the pull tab reporting requirements, that was requested by MMB. And I think Mr. Mossman maybe here
was going to be here
to talk about it. He referred to it as kind of comfort language. And can you explain it? Okay. Mr. Lund will explain it.
Mr. Lund, please identify yourself for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities in Minnesota. And currently the law states that all games, including electronics, the taxes are paid when the game is closed. This will now have the electronics reported the same as bingo events, where they pay the taxes monthly whether the events are closed or not. So this was requested by revenue, and charities actually support this wholeheartedly. So this language was felt to by revenue.
And Mr. Chairman, members, the Department of Revenue feels like they can do this now, but they felt like they wanted to be clear in law anyway.
Thank you, Senator Pappas, and thank you, Mr. Lund. Any questions on the A3 amendment?
Chairman?
Senator Tomasoni. Chairman,
Senator Pappas, was the language that was inadvertently struck have anything to do with bingo?
Senator Pappas.
No.
Oh.
That came out earlier, right? Now.
Senator Tomasoni?
How about bingo cards?
You mean like linked bingo?
Linked
Senator
bingo
Pappas? And now I want you guys to know that this is getting difficult with me, with he's saying something, you saying something, and I'm trying to make sure I get in.
Be quiet for a while. We'll just talk back and forth.
Yeah, I think that's the whole idea. You just want to talk back to each other and pretend I'm not here.
Mr. Chairman.
My wife thinks that from time to time, too. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing to do with bingo in this legislation, so it's not germane.
So, Senator Pappas.
Not germane.
Senator Tomasoni.
No, sorry.
Senator Pappas moves adoption of the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Anything else, Senator Pappas?
No, Mr. Chairman, unless someone else wanted to testify, I would, if not, I would move that Senate file 1006 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The bill has been passed.
Thank you.
And is, I think we have... Senator Pappas, if you don't mind, Senator Disick is here, and we wanted to slip her in expeditiously and then go from there. Welcome to the committee, Senator Disick.
Thank you.
Will someone move adoption of the committee report?
Mr. Chair, I would move that. Senator Stumpf moves it.
Senator Stumpf moves adoption of the committee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. And Senate file 987 is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, before you is Senate File 987, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, also known as LCCMR, the 2013 recommended proposals. This past summer, LCCMR received 169 proposals from its request for proposal process, totaling approximately $155 million. We heard presentations on 69 proposals. We are suggesting 46 proposals be recommended to the 2013 Minnesota Legislature to collectively receive $38.2 million in funding from the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund. These recommendations range from full funding for the full proposals to partial funding for specific proposal elements. In the 2013 request for proposals, we specifically stated we were interested in hearing ways to help control or stop the spread of invasive species because of the potential to seriously damage our environment and economy. We heard many projects that discussed Asian carp, zebra mussels, garlic mustard, emerald ash borer, and other invasives. We are recommending funding several of these projects to help control the spread and stop consequences. The largest funding request of $8.7 million, is to the U of M for an aquatic invasive species research center headed by Dr. Peter Sorensen to develop much-needed expertise and new techniques to control the threat of aquatic invasive species, also known as AIS. Its current focus will be on the Asian and common carp, zebra mussels, and Eurasian water milfoil, but they will be flexible enough to add new programs to address the state's urgent needs as those needs change. It will develop effective tools to locate invasive species, research ways to delay the spread, and create effective techniques for eradication. The center will partner with the DNR, USGS, United States Geology Services, and other interested parties as desired or needed. You have several handouts in the packet, including the biennial report overview and a summary of proposed appropriations by subdivision. 1.67% of our recommendations are for environmental education. Almost 3% is for admin and contract management cost. 10% is for water resources. 21.16% is for natural resource data and information. 28.78% is for aquatic and terrestrial invasive species. And 35.44% is for land, habitat, restoration, and recreation. 22 of our projects we are proposing to recommend are considered statewide projects like the AIS Center, or we have another one called SLICE, Sustaining Lakes in a Changing Environment. This is a program to help develop and implement effective protocols to measure water quality and fisheries management. We have a conservation technical assistance program that provides grants to soil and water boards and other local government units. We have also have a program to improve and control detection of emerald ash borer. We have 13 projects that are regional in greater Minnesota, including a project to evaluate a new approach to forest inventory to reduce costs and improve usability in central, northeast, and northwest Minnesota. We have a project to improve water quality and restore up to 14 lakes in southern Minnesota. We have a project to help restore moose habitat in northeastern Minnesota, and a project to preserve Avon Hills landscape in Stearns County. And this is a project that's a joint effort with St. John's University and several local communities. We have 11 projects that are in the greater 11-county metro area and adjacent areas, like the Frogtown Farm and Park Acquisition. And this was the former Wilder Foundation headquarters, and it leveraged additional nonprofit and other funding to provide increased green space and a demonstration farm to low-income, culturally diverse area in St. Paul. We also have several, there should be some handouts in the project that in your folders that highlight some projects. With me today is Susan Thornton from the director of the LCCMR. And so I don't know if you want to go project by project or if you have any questions or how you want to handle.
Before we do that, Senator Thomas only moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 I didn't quite hear that.
Aye.
I think it passed.
Aye. Again. Aye. Aye.
No.
Aye. We're okay.
Just making you rule, Mr. Chair.
All right. So, Ms. Thornton, did you want to discuss what's in the bill?
Mr. Chair and members, Susan Thornton, director of the LCCMR. I'm here to answer any questions or go through any of the projects that you wish.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator. Forward, two questions I have is, how much acquisition is in this bill, land acquisition? And the reason I ask that is, since I've been serving on the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage, I'm always asked that question that's always been asked of that group. And I know there's some acquisition here. I think the projects are good. I support the projects. And the other question is, on the in the bill, you're making some significant changes with regards to administration. In the past, I understand the DNR has generally been the administrator of these projects, and now there's a total change. Am I correct or incorrect in the that?
In the amendment that we passed in environment, we did switch it to admin. Part of that was that we are having discussions with the DNR and the Department of Administration. They had a really good meeting today, kind of work out how to handle things. There was some concern that the DNR gets money, and so they're a grant recipient, and then they're also a grant manager, and so there was some concern with that. But again, they had a really good meeting. I asked in committee to put the Department of Admin on there so that we could continue discussions. I don't think they totally, I'll be honest, I don't think they totally want to do the grant management process, but to just keep the conversation going, the House bill has the DNR on there, and so just in case for some reason everything fell apart at the last minute, we wanted the admin to be on this bill just so that if something fell apart, but more than likely it will go back to Department of Natural Resources because they had a really, really good productive meeting today.
And as we pointed out, that because I was kind of caught by everybody off guard, that I forgot to mention the motion passed. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up with that, and thank you for that information, Ms. Thornton. I apologize for not getting back to you because I had brought this up earlier, and you and I, and I think the administrator of the LCC, Lasard, Mr. Becker, we're gonna have a conversation, but time seems to be kind of jammed in here. So I appreciate moving forward. I do have one concern, and members should be somewhat concerned, I would hope, moving forward here, that the DNR does, in fact, receive money from several parts of the legacy, and they do administer those dollars. I'm certainly not here defending the DNR or the administration one way or the other. It just, you know, my question is for administration, and we should ask that moving forward. If they're going to do that, you know, do they know specifically about do they have the knowledge that the DNR has with regards to these types of appropriations? Is my only question. So I'd be happy to work with you, too, so whatever.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that is a fair question. I think administration has that same concern. I think they have stated that, you know, they would rely on the DNR's expertise. And so Ms. Thornton can add some more, but I think that's I mean, I think we're going back into the DNR direction.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, Are there any provisions within this bill where AIS monies are going direct to lake associations, or is all the AIS money being funneled to the University of Minnesota?
In this proposal, I don't believe we have any that are going. I don't believe we have any that are going into lake associations. We have several research projects going on. So the AIS Center at the U of M is doing research. There are several projects that are partnerships with. I think USGS. They're doing one on zebra mussels and quagga mussels with possibly with DNR. I know there were some other. I think University St. Thomas. Some other colleges were doing. So this was all mostly research based. And then working with the DNR to figure out where the species are, doing some assessments in the Minnesota River. If you look and see all the film where you have the carp jumping, a lot of that is in where the river is not doing well, and so the quality of health in the Minnesota River hasn't been as good in the past. I think it's getting better, but I think they were really concerned in monitoring that one to just see where stuff was and the quality of it so we can move forward. And then Dr. Sorensen is actually working with Lake Associations and Water District. They do have a partnership, and they're working on a specific project right now with Riley Purgatory Watershed District. So they are, while there's not money here, they are the AI Center is actually doing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, so, for example, you and I had spoken about, you know, Lake Minnetonka is wanting, they had done some bays, and they wanted to expand that. Are there other bills traveling that include things like that?
There's not in this bill. I know I have had conversations with many other watershed districts on next year's LCCMR proposal to start thinking about things. So, but there's nothing in this bill specifically.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dzisek, I've been hearing from my constituents for years, really, just their frustration that they felt like when they voted for the change, that they were also voting to support the on-the-ground, in-the-community efforts to stop the spread of things like zebra mussels and Eurasian milfoil. So, and I've been reading articles that say that we're moving in that direction and that we are, in fact, going to be willing to devote more resources towards that. So can you share just conversations? Were there conversations about that issue? And where do you think the committee is going in the future on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, there continues to be a strong emphasis by the LCCMR on all invasive species, aquatic and terrestrial. You don't want to leave the terrestrial behind.
Mr. Chair, neither do I.
Yeah. And we do have a current request for proposal that's out right now, due June 7th, and we are reaching out. We will work with anybody who wants to draft a proposal for funding that would begin July of 2014. So it would be the next cycle, but we'd certainly be able to help them if you want to direct us to somebody or direct anybody to the LCCMR staff. That's what we're in the business of doing right now. The commission has really been looking on what role the trust fund, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, can play in long-term protection and control of aquatic invasives. And so we have specifically said that not interested in things like weed harvesters and so forth. I'm not saying that's what you're speaking to. But really, you know, let's look at some of those long-term research needs and monitoring needs. That's just been the discussion.
Mr. Chair, for either of you, do you foresee that this would, ever be used for things like boat inspections and staffing, the places, the entry points where people bring their boats?
I believe that might be in part of a Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I believe that might be part of a current, I know in Senator Thomasoni's environmental bill, there might be some money working with lake associations to do that. And there's also Clean Water Fund and other funds. So I think, people are very much aware, and I know in the Environment Committee we're very much aware of that issue. Thank you.
Cernino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Senator Ingebrigtsen's question, it sounds like the leaning is going back towards probably putting that decision-making or oversight into DNR, but we still do currently have, excuse me, still do currently have in this bill, as amended in the division, the Department of Administration. Now, if we send it out of here to the floor and if it passes off the floor and the Department of Administration is in the final bill that passes off the Senate floor, coming out of conference committee, that's a distinct possibility. Why is it that we should leave the Department of Administration here in the bill rather than changing it before that becomes a possibility? I'm just trying to drive that down a little bit.
When we drafted the bill, they were still having conversations, and just because of everybody's – Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Nino. Because of everybody's schedule, just getting the next meeting, they have sent – they met actually earlier today, and it went well. So, I mean, I would be fine if everybody's comfortable changing it back to the DNR, or we can leave it as admin with the understanding that that is just an emergency fallback in case everything falls apart. But more than likely, it will come back with the DNR. Because the House bill actually has the DNR, and so that's the – I mean, I'm open to whatever the committee wishes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I echo that same concern, and I certainly would take you at your word that we're going to do that, or you're going to do that moving forward, and that might be an awkward position. But I know the House, you said, has got that in their position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator President. They have the DNR.
Okay. My other question would be the acquisition part of the question. How many acres? And I'm noticing a lot of expenditures going towards parks and trails. Is that unusual, or you know, that's a question that I would direct it. Ms. Thornton, with regards to the past, I guess I don't remember acquisitions or parks funding coming out of LCCMR, and I might be way wrong on that. But please remind me if that's the case.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen and members, we have the LCMR and LCCMR has a long history of proud history of funding parks and trails acquisition and development, both at the state level, the metro regional level, and at the local level. The base of a lot of the Mesabi Trail funding, for instance, has come from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And in this bill before you, for terrestrial and aquatic habitat acquisition, it's approximately $2.9 million. And then for parks and trails acquisition, now this also includes acquisition of land in the University Landscape Arboretum. That's approximately $4.5 million. So it's possibly a little smaller.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, if I could, then on page 3 of the acquisitions here, there's explain to me the 12 acres, partial or portion of 12 acres purchased in Frogtown Farm and Park, established St. Paul City Park. Can you explain to me how those acres are coming about, not being from there, not knowing that park at all? Is there property? Obviously, there's properties available, and what kind of cost is that?
Mr. Chair, that was Mr. Senator Ingebrigtsen, that was the old Wilder Foundation headquarters, and so it became available, and it was in one parcel, and so I think it was several nonprofits were involved in that, and then so that we were able to leverage our money and complete it with their money. I'm looking up the specific details as we're talking.
Mr. Chair. Call on Ms. Thornton.
Yeah. Yeah, Ms. Thornton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, so I'll fill in a little bit here. Yes, it is the property. The buildings have been raised on that property, and the community, the City of St. Paul, and several NGOs have been working to acquire this property. There is an option on the property, and working with Wilder, there's a donation from Wilder. Foundation, and there will be an additional $1.45 million raised that for part of the acquisition and then part of the development restoration. So it's a partnership.
Thank you.
Senator Stump?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman.
On this issue.
Senator Pappas?
I just wanted to fill in a little bit about Frogtown Farm. So it'll be an kind of an urban farm, if you will, that will do education for urban kids on kind of model farming and cooking and raising, you know, raising crops. And it's in an area of the city where there's very little green space. Right. And so it's very unusual to have that large amount of green space available in a fully developed urban area. And we're just very fortunate that actually the economy was poor that nobody else wanted to buy it and develop it into anything else. And it's not in a good location for housing anyway because it's not near the University Avenue, the light rail line. So it just, there were some really dedicated people in the community that really had a vision here for what they wanted to do.
Thank you.
And the Trust for Public Lands really stepped up to the plate to help fund it.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, just a question on page 14, lines 8 through 20. When we deal with the invasive species, we've put a lot of money into, or the different organizations in the state has put a lot of money into trying to control the some of the invasive species, in particular the carp. And I know I kind of was whistling in the wind a number of years ago when I suggested that there might be other options other than the ones that they've been pursuing. The Department of Natural Resources, I think, in trying to prevent the carp from going upstream, are going to spend, I guess, millions of dollars on a light and sound show to try to keep them from going upstream. And I'm just wondering if, you know, there may be missing some opportunity to actually do, you know, do the right thing instead of, you know, I mean, some way to really stop them. I think there's some more positive ways to do it than lights and sound.
Senator Stump, there should be a handout in your packet on the AIS Center. Dr. Sorensen was involved when I think it was the sea lamprey was another invasive species at some point, and so he helped involved stopping that. They're literally looking at the DNA. They're looking at carp larvae and fish eggs, and so carp eggs are actually kind of like a delicatessen, or you know, other fish. Yes, thank you. Other fish love eating them, and so they're looking at everything from sound waves and how does that impact them to the. Is there a way that they can target their DNA? And this is at the youth that they can target their DNA to stop them from jumping, to stop the spread, to you know, all sorts of things, and then also looking at again creative stuff like can we get other fish to eat them. And so they are really using science to help, you know, stop the spread, and more than just a light show, they are using science.
No, I mean Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Stump's concern, I've been fortunate to hear a lot of testimony about with Dr. Sorensen. We're very fortunate to have him in our university. In fact, I think he's nationally renowned. Doctor of carp. I'm not saying that with a smile on my face for any particular reason, though. I think he is. I think he actually does and has been researching carp his whole career. So we're very fortunate to have him there. And And what Senator Stumpf is talking about is the barriers, is the CARP barriers, I believe you're talking about. And there's been a lot of discussion on whether we should have electronic or we should have sound bubblers. Sound bubblers are almost no figure out in 70% or 80%, which isn't very reassuring or very assuring to us upstream that that's going to stop anything, especially in the 100-year flood situation, which we're not experiencing here in Minnesota by any stretch. But so, you know, I know that he's doing some good research, has been, and this is going to be, I mean, certainly as part of the equation. And Senator's right with the Great Lakes, with the situation they had there. They basically have not stopped it totally, but they've turned that around to attribute, you know, a larger number of fish population because of the research that's come out of there. But it really needed an uplifting. It really needed a facelift. But I agree with you with regards to the barriers. I'm not sure that this has been going on. I mean, the governor was good enough to have a CARP summit here, I think it was called, some time ago, and I was there, and there was some real concern about going with electric or versus the lights and the bubble barriers, and electronics certainly is the way to go, but now you have to get the federal government involved, and they don't move real quickly, and they even testified to that fact that they just don't move very quickly, and even if requested to move a little quicker, that didn't seem to work. So I certainly share your concern.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's many times that I've gone fishing that I wish a fish would jump in the boat.
Mr. Chair, to that point, one would have to wear a helmet if you're going to have these kind of fish around when you do the boating to the fishing area, actually, so it's quite dangerous. But they do have what's called redneck fishing. You actually stand in the back of the boat with either a bow or, I believe, a shotgun or a baseball bat with spears on it to be able to do that kind of fishing. So I don't think we want that, though, in our lakes and streams.
Okay, Mr. Bowdern, before we go on, I think there was a technical amendment we needed on page, was it 6?
Shooting fish with a shotgun.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, Mr. Nauman very alertly spotted. There's one blank here that the division report didn't fill in. On page 6, line 35, you'll see a blank there, and be consistent with the way the division report handled this, I'd recommend including the word administration. Delete the blank and insert administration.
Okay, Senator Tomasoni makes that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I missed this question when it was in my committee, but the program for enhancing timber sale program, I'm not clear what it means. Evaluate how timber payment methods impact post-harvest forest ecological conditions.
What line are you on?
It's 5.1, but it's the last program on your spreadsheet here. That small spreadsheet. It says, and I'm not sure what they mean by, if it's timber payments to the trust fund or timber payments to, I mean, what is this? Evaluate timber payments. Thornton, I think, probably knows.
Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, it's something I learned myself this last summer. My understanding is that there are two methods. One is consumer scale, pay as a cut, and the other is an appraised volume, which is a fixed amount, and they are done in various ways. Cass County and the U.S. Forest Service use the appraised volume. DNR does some of both. This will be looking at the ecological benefits of the differing alternatives and the economic benefits of the differing alternatives, and with the goal being potentially to, if they can show potential to reduce the overhead, and of course this would have an impact for sales of timber on our state lands, including school trust lands. And I took it as far as I could.
That's a good thing.
Hope so.
Okay. Is there further discussion on Senate File 987? Sir Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dietzick on line on page 20 of line 27. It talks about a recipient of money from an appropriation in this section must give consideration for contracting with the Conservation Corps of Minnesota. I'm just wondering, was there a specific amount of money that was being discussed in regards to this group?
No.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, no.
And Mr. Chair,
Anderson.
Senator Dietzick, the consideration for this group for all projects under the LCCMR?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, mostly it's just for restoration and conservation programs. I believe they do work with some of the Bowser groups throughout the state on different projects, and so it was and they've worked with LCCMR, so it was just added in there because several people on the committee like the program, and so just to further support that group. And it also helps get people into the conservation and environmental programs.
Hey, further questions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, there's also been a lot of talk about the citizen input on these groups. And is the bill before us reflective of the consensus of the group? How closely does this bill follow the recommendations that were made?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, this is unanimous vote of what we recommended.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there further questions on Senate File 987? Any motions? Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 987 as amended be recommended to pass. There's no further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Dietzick, Ms. Thornton.
Thank you.
Then we have our last bill tonight, Senate File 1294, Senator Pappas. Senator Lori moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries, I believe.
All the testifiers, come on.
This is what we're going to do. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While I'm talking, could I have the A1 amendment passed out?
Okay, if we could have that distributed, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, 1294 is actually a policy bill that was previously passed by this committee, but we pulled it back from the floor so we could add this A1 amendment, which would establish an appropriation that would go to the Ramsey County Attorney's Office to develop model protocol and training regarding sex trafficking. Just a little background, Minnesota Safe Harbor Law was signed, Safe Harbor Act was signed into law in 2011 to ensure that child victims of sex trafficking would be recognized as just that, victims, and would be connected to safe shelter and therapeutic services that they need to heal and to feel secure in cooperating with the prosecution of their traffickers. The Safe Harbor Act doesn't go into effect until August 2014. One of the primary reasons for the delayed implementation is to allow time for law enforcement professionals to be trained to effectively identify child sex trafficking victims and to aggressively investigate child sex trafficking cases. This amendment allocates resources to the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and the County Attorney John Choi has been a leader in this area, to develop statewide training curriculum based on their nation-leading expertise in this area and working in collaboration with law enforcement agencies around the state to conduct regional training sessions for law enforcement professionals. So, of course, I have with me Ramsey County Attorney John Choi.
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, first of all, I just want to thank Senator Pappas for her leadership, and you too, Senator Cohen, Senator Lowry, for your efforts that's here around this really important issue. I really believe that this issue about the buying and selling of our children for sex is one of the darkest things that is happening in our community. And I want to make sure that we make absolutely no mistake. This is not an urban issue. This is a statewide issue. In fact, in 2012, We prosecuted 12 defendants involving the prostitution of children. Almost half of those young girls came from outstate Minnesota, not from the Twin Cities area. And so this is an issue that impacts all of us. And 2011, with respect to our fight against this really despicable crime, was an important year, because that was the year that the Safe Harbor Law passed. And that was also the year that county attorneys in the metropolitan area, all seven of us, and then in St. Louis County and in Olmsted County, before the law was even put into effect, we made a very important announcement that we believe that from a law enforcement perspective, the best way to tackle this crime is to develop a victim-centered response. And through that, what we mean by that is that these girls, children, sometimes boys under the age of 18, we should not be treating them as delinquents, but they are victims of crime. They are children in need of protection. And so with that protocol, we start with this premise that when we engage with a young victim, they are not a delinquent, and we're there to help them. And because of that way of doing things, we have in the past year, in 2012, we've come forward with 12 defendants that we've charged with the trafficking or promotion of prostitution of children. And then just recently, this year alone, we're already up to 6 defendants. We've got 2 cases in our office right now, but we're putting these cases together. And these are really hard cases to pull together. And this policy that we're doing, the statewide policy that you enacted, is a major policy shift, but it works. And I really believe that this amendment that is before you, the training of law enforcement, is so critical. And the Ramsey County Attorney's Office is, I think, positioned very well to be the entity that would further the vision of getting all of the law enforcement agencies and prosecution trained, because right now we are currently engaged in a really important project, which is to go backwards in time to review past runaway cases, because there is such an important connection to vulnerable children and ending up as victims. And so we've gleaned so much information by going backwards in the time and looking at some of those runaway cases. And what we have found, and in your packets, there's a PowerPoint presentation which discusses our findings and kind of our next steps and conclusions about what we ought to be doing around this topic. But this work, the funding for that was made in part by the Minnesota Women's Foundation. But that funding is only for the development of, or to do this case review, to do the, to develop protocol within Ramsey County and then develop a toolkit. But there are no funds at all to spread the protocol and to do the training statewide outside of Ramsey County. And so with this amendment, working together with the St. Paul Police Department and the Minneapolis Police Department, who both agencies have done a really phenomenal job with respect to the investigation of these cases, I believe that there's a great need to ensure that law enforcement throughout this state are properly trained to identify these situations. And there's also a Star Tribune article that highlights some of these findings. But, you know, oftentimes, first thing, we got to raise awareness of this issue, because we've got police officers who are pulling people over, but they're just kind of moving on to the next thing. And I think that's just because of a lack of awareness. And we also have to we have to talk about and train on this victim-centered model about how best to do that. And the Safe Harbor bill that is being pending before this legislature that Senator Pappas is carrying in the Senate and Senator Lowry has made possible, but that effort about providing that certain services and having the funds necessary to support that victim-centered approach is going to be a great tool in our fight against sex trafficking. And so, members, I'm here today to end sex trafficking, and I hope that you would help join us with that fight by providing these dollars for law enforcement. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, members, let me be clear that Senator Lowry has funded this initiative with $4 million in his omnibus bill, but it's for the shelter beds only. And he wasn't able to accommodate the request for training. And the chairman did come up with some money on the bottom line to, you know, we had a bigger request, but this will partially get us there in terms of the training effort. Also, I have with me a more kind of frontline people who are on the front line on this issue, and that is Sergeant Ray Ganey from the St. Paul Police Department and Sergeant Grant Snyder from the Minneapolis Police Department, that they can share with you a few words on their experiences.
Sergeant, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Sergeant Ray Ganey from the St. Paul Police Department. Members, I'd just like to echo what John Choi said about the training is necessary for our officers, it's necessary for our investigators, and it's also necessary for our school resource officers. If you saw in the article that you have, the Washington case that we recently made several arrests on in April, in that case alone, one night, officers from two different agencies came into contact with a trafficker that had three young women and girls in his car. Those officers, unfortunately, didn't recognize the situation that was right in front of them. Multiple officers, different agencies, the same night came into contact with these people, and nothing was done about it. So after doing the interviews on the Washington case, after every interview, I would have to ask the victim if they had any mental health issues. And each time, one of these victims would identify some of the mental health issues that they had. These men are preying on vulnerable girls that do not have the ability to defend themselves from what's happening to them. And we want our officers to be able to identify that. We currently provide training for officers around the metro area, but also around the Midwest in a class that the police department puts on. We've seen an increase in the number of agencies that are sending people to that class across the Midwest, not just in Minnesota, but the surrounding states. And we want to continue to do that and carry that training throughout the state instead of just right here in the metro area. Many of you may have known that there are individual heroes that are working on this effort. The St. Paul Police Department and the Minneapolis Police Department gets called on a regular basis from other agencies looking for help with these cases. We want to educate these other agencies. We want to train these other agencies so they can handle their own cases, and we can handle our cases in our jurisdictions as well. Thank you.
Sergeant, if I can ask, I've had a chance to talk to the county attorney a little bit about this, but is there a prototype elsewhere in the country in terms of a particular law enforcement department, agency, jurisdiction, where the work with trafficking has done quite well that might serve as a model for what we're doing or what we would be attempting to do?
Yes, I think we could reach out to a couple other human trafficking task forces across the state to see what they're doing as well, possibly in Boston or maybe in the Dallas area.
And is there any particular area that this is at a higher level just in terms of numbers of victims?
When you say any area, can you be more specific?
Well, I mean, is New York a magnet for this as opposed to, you know, Chicago? Or is it just cropping up everywhere around the country?
I think you would see that it's cropping up everywhere. If you were to go on backpage.com and look at the ads in any city, you would see ads for this activity.
13. Okay. And Sergeant, did you wish to testify? Maybe we could just have, I'm sorry, Mr. Newman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'll wait if you want to let the Minneapolis Sergeant testify first, then I'll ask my question.
Sergeant?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sergeant Grant Snyder, with Minneapolis Police Department. I'm the lead investigator on all sex trafficking cases in our department. I've been fortunate enough over the past couple of years to be able to travel fairly extensively across the country and conduct trainings to places like Austin, Texas, Denver, Seattle, Boston, North Dakota. And so my perspective on this comes from an acknowledgement of how important training is to our police officers and our prosecutors. At these classes where we've been able to hold and talk about some advanced investigative techniques, talk about advanced interviewing techniques and different things like that, that makes such an impact, not only in how the victim's handled at the outset, but also how that victim's handled throughout the case development. It's routine for us to go to places, and North Dakota was no different than other places that we've been to, where we're talking to a lot of places, a lot of officers, a lot of jurisdictions, where they don't have the sort of backbone, the sort of infrastructure that we do in the Twin Cities area to be able to conduct in-services for our police officers. And so when we put out our PowerPoint and we cover all the material that we've got, they're left with their heads spinning because of all of the different requests that are being made and the different demands that are being made on their jurisdictions. Quite recently, I had a case where we had followed up on a Duluth report, and it was, like Sergeant Ganey had referred to, we'd been requested to assist Duluth in a report of 13 juvenile females that got off a bus in Duluth with a 39-year-old man that had come from Minneapolis. And there was a call that was made to the police department, but there was never a police report filed. None of those individuals were ever identified. They were multi-race, mixed race. It was clear that there was no legitimate reason for them being there. And from there, they went on, they got on a bus, went to Fargo, and then went to Williston, North Dakota, which, as many of you know, is ground zero right now for sex trafficking. So I want to really underscore the importance that the only way we prevent that from happening is by making sure that not only as investigators that everybody knows what to look for and how to conduct those interviews, that as line officers, the people that are on the that are the boots on the ground on this particular issue, that they're recognizing the signs and they know how to respond appropriately. Today we conducted an in-service training for our officers, and it lasted about an hour and a half, during which time we toppled many of the ideologies that encumber the way that our police, the way that people look at these issues and these victims. And so that is probably training currently right now is our biggest issue and our biggest barrier, if you will, to doing a good job in combating sex trafficking.
Thank you, Sergeant. Sergeant Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Choi, would it be fair to assume that there aren't any other departments or agencies within the state of Minnesota that are putting together a similar program so that we know we aren't funding a program where there is going to be, in effect, a duplication of efforts?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I mean, I think the reality is that this money could go to the Department of Public Safety. It could go in many different places. But I think I'm raising my hand to say I'm willing to do this. And this causes great stress within our own agency because none of this benefits us. What it does is that the goal here is to basically train all of law enforcement. And I wouldn't call it a program, but what we have is we've undertaken a significant amount of investment, more than probably any other prosecution agency in the state, to really take a really systematic look at some of these gaps so that we can help other agencies identify, and we did that along with the St. Paul Police Department. But we've undertaken probably the first of its kind in the nation to actually go backwards in time. And because we have this very fundamental belief that it's those runaway cases or it's those vulnerable girls, that's where this information lies. In fact, Sergeant Ray Ganey will say many times that the information that we need to solve and to end sex trafficking actually exists within our own databases in the police department, in our child protection files, in our county attorney files. What we need to do is kind of connect those dots, and we've been doing that. And so as a part of pulling this research together into going backwards in time, that review, I think, positions us very well because we've learned so much, so many lessons about where those gaps might be, certainly in our agencies, but then where they might be in other agencies, and to help them with developing these training protocols. And to the extent that the state is wanting, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office will be willing to provide, I guess, that leadership to carry the work that we've been doing forward. And so this is a good way to leverage, I believe, the investments that have already been made.
Senator Babbitt.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the answer to Senator Newman's question is no, that there is no one else in the state who is providing this training. The Department of Public Safety is not. Hennepin County is not. St. Louis County is not. No one is.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Mr. Chairman, and that is, of course, the answer that I was
I was looking for it. If I could ask one.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify that. There might be some in-service training going on, as Sergeant Snyder mentioned, but not developing a protocol, developing a model training, and they're contracting with other people to come in and provide that training, and et cetera.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Senator Pappas, for that, and Mr. Choi, for that explanation. One more question, Mr. Choi. Perhaps Senator Pappas could show you the A1 amendment, get in front of you, go to line 9. What you're trying to do is identify and intervene sexually exploited trafficked youth. The word youth strikes me as being somewhat odd in that, you know, are you simply trying to target minors? Or is youth a word that you are anticipating that you would be trying to help just young people, say, of college age? Or it strikes me as being a somewhat ambiguous legal term, and that's why I'm asking the question, who are you really going after here?
Yeah.
And is there maybe a better word that you could use to define the program that you're trying to implement?
Mr. Chairman, sure. Senator, I think what was intended by the word youth is anyone under the age of 18. However, I will state, and I bet the committee would agree, that there really isn't a difference between someone who's 17 and 19. It's still an atrocity that they're being bought and sold for sex. The work and the research that we have done to date has been focused around victims under the age of 18 who have been prostituted, trafficked, exploited. So that's the work that we've been doing. But if this committee wants to change that, I mean, I certainly would be open to that. From my perspective, there is no difference.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I'm sorry. Senator Newman, were you done?
Well,
I'm sorry, Senator Newman.
Yeah, I was just going to make one more comment. And I certainly support Senator Pappas' bill. I wouldn't intend to. She has a lot more information on this than I would have, but I would not think it to be a good, wise decision to limit this training to only minors. You're going to wind up with 19-year-old girls and 20-year-old girls, and that's why I asked the question about youth. That we could interpret that to mean youngsters that are older than 18 years of age is. So it just, Senator Pappas, I want you to do what you feel is appropriate with Mr. Choi, but those are my thoughts.
Victims down here.
Mm-hmm. Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, we could change that word to victims. That's the word that's used on line 114. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting an amendment?
Senator Newman wants to make that amendment, or I can make it.
I would so move, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
So, Senator Newman, what you're moving?
Strike the word "youth" and insert the word "victims."
Okay.
On line 9.
All right. With Senator Newman's amendment in front of us, is there discussion on the amendment? If not, all is in. Yeah. Senator Lurie.
You know, just combining this with the rest of the bill. I mean, I need to just raise a question. I mean, a part of this bill is making it no longer a crime if you're under the age of 18. And so that's where you consider the individual a victim, and it is still considered a crime if you're above the age of 18. And that's part of this distinction that's at the core of this bill. So I'm not opposing this amendment. I do believe the term victim probably is applicable beyond the age of 18, but I do think we're getting kind of at the
Mr. Chairman,
core of the distinction made in the bill here.
Very good distinction. How about if I was to withdraw my amendment and replace it with the word individuals?
Well, but relative to Senator Lurie's point, just to take it a step further, Senator Newman, if you look at the head note on the bill, it makes Senator Lurie's note or comment pretty clear, where it references 16 and 17-year-olds. So, Senator Newman,
I withdraw my amendment. I am now buggering up Senator Pappas' bill. I did not intend to do that. And I'm sure that she and Mr. Choi could give it some further thought.
as appropriate.
Well, it strikes me as a valid point, but at least relative to the bill as it went through Senator Lurie's division, and again, just referencing other language in the bill, if we were to change the bill, it would be more than just the single word, I think. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator, for withdrawing that. I think the youth thing captures what we're after here, what Senator Pappas is after, and the testifiers. And once we get to that, solving that problem, then we can deal with the ones that are a little bit older, quite frankly. I think this is so long overdue here. I look at the presentation here, and coming from that world, I know what families not reporting the girls missing because they didn't want to put their names in the system, and it would be embarrassing, and they're going to put their family's name in a system, and I know that's a thing that the law enforcement has to deal with all the time. You know, are you going to report your daughter missing, or aren't you? You know, help us a little bit here. And without that education piece in here, families are sitting out there spinning. But the law, if I can just bring a little bit of history back to what I recall, and I know Senator Cohen is good about doing the history of the Senate. Let me bring you a little bit of law enforcement history with regards to Minnesota being the leader in Duluth area of domestic abuse and training in domestic abuse from years ago. I think that model came out of Duluth and still is and was recognized as a national program. And this could very well be the same thing, and I know the law enforcement professionals certainly need a lot of help here with regards to identifying this, and I think this is a great thing, and I'm certainly in favor of this, and I know there's certainly an issue. My question to Mr. Choi, is it? Yes, you said there was 12 convictions in Ramsey County. Is that in Ramsey County or statewide? I'm sorry.
In Ramsey County, Senator.
Okay, how about statewide? What was the numbers? Do we know, or is that some of the stuff you're going to try and get to here with this appropriation?
I don't know the answer, Mr. Chairman, Senator. I do not know the answer to that statewide. But just being someone that does follow this issue pretty closely, there just really aren't a lot of these sex trafficking cases because they're just very difficult to pull together. And there's some of these gaps about why that's the case, I think, are articulated in this document here. But there are many more, I think, victims of sexual exploitation and trafficking that we are now becoming aware of. And so there is this huge gap. And in fact, before 2012, the average amount of these types of cases that we would have would be about 4 to 7 defendants a year for the second largest county in the state. So now in 2012, we had 12 defendants charged. And then in 2013, this year alone, we're, you know, just kind of just starting the year, and we're at the we've already got 6 defendants. So we need to do a better job of I think there's this gap with respect to the victims and then figuring out how we're going to find the traffickers and prosecute them. I think that's one of our biggest challenges. But I think in terms of ending sex trafficking, we have to be very aggressive in our pursuit of the traffickers. And so this appropriation will help in that regard.
And just one more comment, if I could, Mr. Chair. And rural members ought to be paying attention to this as well, because this is where they're coming to do their trafficking.
Yeah.
And with you willing to step up and put together a program, a training for officers, as well as some family education, I commend you and Senator Pappas for moving this direction. Thank you.
Senator Banos.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Choi or any of the sergeants, I don't know if you were aware that the city of Plymouth, has a big problem with regard to trafficking, and that the city council, have actually identified it as an area of concern. Apparently there's a strip along Highway 55 with motels where a significant amount of trade is going on. And so the police chief, Chief Goldstein, is very aware of it, and I know the city council is working on it. And so I wondered if you have ever talked to them or if you were aware that that was an issue.
While we're changing seats here, Sergeant Snyder just told me that there were 18 prosecutions in Minneapolis last year.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for bringing up that point. In this last case that we did with the Washington family, we identified an arrest that had taken place in Plymouth. And the reason that we were able to identify that arrest was through the use of an intel analyst that was assigned to the BCA. We use that analyst to look at the big picture because we realize that these prostitution rings aren't just operating in St. Paul or Minneapolis, but it's around the whole state. So we were able to grab that arrest that took place in Plymouth and tie it directly to our case.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, all of you, I'm very grateful that you're bringing this forward and that you're tackling it. Thank you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I had the same line of questioning that Senator Newman had as far as we agree that this is a good cause, and then the question would be is what entity would be the best to do this? Mr. Choi, I'm very familiar with the work you've done on this in recent years. The question I had is on line 16 that we're going to grant you permission to partner with other entities, and I was wondering if you could tell me what that means.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, it's still, I think we have to think this through, but certainly an important partner, an integral partner in all this would be the St. Paul Police Department and the Minneapolis Police Department because they've got a strong commitment and a history of working on these issues, and I think they could help develop this training. And I think the most important part of this, I mean, it's important to make sure our prosecutors are across the state that are properly trained about the new law and working with law enforcement. But also, I think on the front lines is so critical. And so, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul would certainly be a part of that. And I think another part of this, too, is because we are now embracing a victim-centered approach to all of this, I do believe that victim advocates need to be a part of the development of the protocol.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Limmer.
Mr. Choi, I might... you know, I don't think this went through the Judiciary Committee, at least for any type of visit to understand what we're doing, but I think Senator Ingebrigtsen brought up a good point. This is not just an urban issue, and I hope that your entities that you're going to work with are some of our rural law enforcement partners, because there's a lot of things going on. There's gentlemen clubs along very desolate highways out in rural Minnesota. Along with those clubs comes a fairly active trade in this area, and so we need to follow that a little bit. Don't stay focused on the urban area because it's far beyond that. The perhaps if we would have had a larger or a longer discussion somewhere in the Judiciary Policy Committee, we might have been able to give you more suggestions. I think it's a laudatory effort to pursue, and wish you good luck.
Mr. Chairman, Sergeant Grant would like to comment. Sergeant Snyder.
Sergeant
oh,
Snyder.
No, I'm sorry. Who's sitting
Mr.
next
Chair,
to me? Sergeant Ganey is sitting next to me.
Sergeant
sorry.
Ganey.
They changed places.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to mention that currently the St. Paul Police Department is involved in an enhanced effort with the United States Attorney's Office, and that includes providing some funding to investigators in Duluth and also in Rochester. We've traveled to those cities to provide training and also conduct undercover operations in those cities with those investigators. So we certainly realize that we need to branch out to those other parts of the state as well.
Mr. Chair, I'm even getting police reports that truck stops out in rural Minnesota are very popular places, along with wayside rests. So it seems to be everywhere. And so let's give you a few more pointers.
Thank you.
And Sergeant Snyder, if I could ask, you mentioned Williston as being kind of the epicenter. Is that the type of place? I mean, a little bit I've read about what's going on in North Dakota, it sounds like places are kind of variations of gold rush towns. Is that, I guess my stereotype was that it would take place, you know, the epicenter would be maybe a place where you had real vulnerable kids, an immigrant center, you know, New York or Atlanta, cities like that. But when you mentioned Williston, it sounds like kind of the wild, wild west areas are the places where it might happen, at least based on what you suggested.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. That's a very good question. It's important. Williston right now is suffering from a whole variety of different issues that are all related to this massive expansion of growth and the number of people that have moved into the area and are encumbered by police departments, which are unfortunately, and social agencies, which are unfortunately not really qualified and equipped to deal with that investigatively or through their experience and different things like that. Your term of Wild Wild West is exactly how when we did the training in Bismarck, there were guys from Williston there from that police department and from Newtown and other places like that, and they had the same description of their areas, the Wild Wild West. There's places that they simply don't go. To your question about or your observation or statement about, you know, going to places like Atlanta and different things like that, the key point I think there is that sex trafficking exists because it makes people money. It's a lucrative, funded operation that's run as an organized crime venture. And so wherever sex trafficking can produce money for someone, there are people that will do it, whether that's here or Duluth or Williston or wherever. So that's what we find, is that we find places like Williston that's blowing up right now. And Duluth is no different than that. There's other places. We had a case in Moorhead recently.
But certainly today, with a lot of sophistication, I assume that didn't exist. A lot more sophistication than would have existed in the Wild Wild West days.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, sir.
It's at the risk of telling a story, years ago when I was a kid and was in Helena, I tracked down, ended up meeting somebody who had been a former president of a bank who had come to Helena turn of the century, and he talked about Helena being the Wild Wild West. It was like out of the movies. And he said all the blue blood families in Helena were all descended from prostitutes, which I thought was striking. But it sounds like it's almost a variation, a latter-day variation on that theme. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Choi, you mentioned that this funding here would go for helping with the gaps. And I'm guessing, as was mentioned, Senator Ingebrigtsen mentioned something about parents not wanting to or family members not wanting to make a report on their runaway daughter or son, whatever. How many people do you estimate are runaway that you or people that there's reports in your past that you maybe have fallen through the gaps here and need to go back and pick up on? And do you have enough FTEs to do this work? It seems like this big accomplishment. Project to take on.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, just in St. Paul alone, there's over 1,000 runaways. Just in St. Paul.
In a year.
Females. And so. A big part of that is, of course, making that connection between the runaways. But this money, I think specifically, the mission is to take the lessons that we have learned from the case review that we have been doing. We've identified gaps within our own system. And what we want to do is use that as a basis to put together training protocols and help other agencies identify their gaps and these dollars are for training. It's not necessarily to fix our gaps that we might have. It's for the purpose of training. So there's limited dollars here, $300,000, and that's very much focused on, because by the end of this year, we will have actually completed a model protocol for law enforcement and prosecution within Ramsey County and a toolkit, but we don't have the resources to disseminate, to convene, and to further the vision of getting this out to all law enforcement agencies across the state, and this appropriation would make that a possibility and a reality.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Choi, do you have enough people?
We will figure out a way to get that done. And it's not just within my own agency. I think it's going to be a shared obligation on the part of others, such as the people in the St. Paul Police Department, Minneapolis Police Department, and working together with all of the law enforcement agencies across the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, this, of course, is just focusing on police and first responders and prosecutors in terms of training to identify. The bigger problem, you know, you've identified part of the bigger problem, is that, you know, runaways are certainly at risk of being, you know, enticed or captured by traffickers. They could start out with trading sex for shelter. So, you know, the Homeless Youth Act and having shelter for homeless youth is really very important. But these victims actually need to be housed separately from homeless youth because it's danger surrounds them, because their trafficker is going to be looking for them to, you know, to get them out of secure shelter, out of the shelter where they're at, and back into the trafficking game. So it's very tricky. You know, you need, you know, probably street workers to identify people, like Breaking Free does for adult women mostly, although they have some minors that are in their program. And then keep them away from their trafficker and then put them into some kind of secure shelter. But then the whole issue of, you know, educating and warning girls, if you're at the Mall of America and you're kind of a vulnerable, low-ego 13-year-old and some handsome guy comes up and says, I want to be your boyfriend and you're beautiful and I'll make you a movie star, I mean, you know. And it just goes from there, and then they kind of get caught into, you know, you're my girlfriend, and I want you to have sex and make money for me. You know, so it's really very difficult with these young, vulnerable girls. They may come from rural Minnesota. They may come from the suburbs. And we have an education process to do, you know, like to inoculate them against this, the efforts to recruit them.
Sarah Stump.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. This ties into a request that we have in the Capital Investment Committee relating to the Tubman Center. And they have a request into, I believe, remodel remodel two floors, which I think would generate something like 24 rooms or something. Anyway, it is specifically for runaways, and so, you know, members might see that. I believe it's Senator Wieger's proposal. So,
well, and Mr. Chairman, there are several social service agencies. 180 Degrees is another one that are willing to kind of step up to the plate and provide shelter for girls if we help them with the funding.
Senator Pappas, you've had distributed the A1 amendment. We have not adopted that yet.
I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay. So on the amendment, is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion on Senate File 1294.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nino.
Well, I don't want to.
No, I was going to make the motion, so go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask. I think this is. Maybe it wasn't both this week, but I think it was the second bill this week we've tracked on Mr. Nauman's computer there over there on the bottom line. I'm just wondering, do we have any more spare change on the bottom line for other projects?
That's a secret. Let's see.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
I would move that Senate File 1294 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Let me more seriously answer Senator Nino. Senator Gilbertson talked about the history of the Senate. Historically, we've reached this point in the session. There is some bottom line money for these bills that do come through the Finance Committee. And we do track them. There is some money available at the bottom line. We try to be a little bit judicious in its use. And then at the end, you know, once we're done with our work, and we're not going to, you know, just bring bills in to pass them just to use up the money. To be honest with you, Senator Nino, it won't be a surprise. Sometime next week, we're going to have another bill of Senator Pappas's, which is her omnibus pension bill. That will have the serious money in it, and depending on how members feel, obviously. But her request is going to be a significant one. So, you know, we track the money. Obviously, we're being very careful about it, if at the conclusion of finance committee meetings that bottom line money is not used, it stays at the bottom line. It's not going to be used in any untoward way. So that's the more serious answer to your question.